Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So still got it out of my mind, Space Force. I'm really looking forward to the new uniforms. My kids are thrilled, because we watched Lost in Space, the Netflix series. So my kids are kind of in the world that I was when they were ages 8, 9, 10. I'm thrilled with Space Force. Can't wait. The great merchandising, the little toys. It's going to be fabulous. Also, it's going to be a huge opportunity for grift, for kleptocracy to continue and us to be robbed blind. But it's still going to have cute little outfits. Cannot wait. I'm here to share some thoughts, not just on Space Force, but also the week that was. I've asked David Pakman to come talk with us. David is a nationally syndicated host of The David Pakman Show. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So Space Force, you ready for it?
It's just so depressing because you can talk about the idea as an idea, but then when you remember all the stuff we supposedly can't afford, and then you think about what the Space Force would actually cost. I mean, we're talking about almost being able to end hunger altogether for what the Space Force would cost. We're talking about, Medicare for All, of course, would be a net savings. But aside from that, you're talking about amounts of money that could be used to do really, really important and great things. And that's really the depressing thing to me, which is whatever shiny thing Trump mentions that becomes the discussion, there's like the layer one conversation about the merits of it. Like, okay, well, what happens if we're not first to control this resource in space or that other? But if we're talking about fiscal conservatism, which Trump claims to want to do, what about all the stuff that would cost less that we say we simply can't afford?
Yeah, but has he ever taken the fiscal conservative mantra? I don't think I've ever actually heard him say that he's a fiscal conservative. I have heard him say that he loves debt. He's the king of debt. I have heard him say that. But I don't know the conservative part, the financial part. I don't think I've ever heard that.
No, certainly not in those words, right? But I mean, he has talked about he is going to be the person that figures out the debt problem with China owning our debt, or he's the one who's going to undo whatever Obama supposedly did when it comes to debt and deficit, and he does the opposite. So yeah, he's not using the same language as sort of like the more seasoned Republicans, but he's made similar allusions, and obviously he is not governed that way, and you know that. You've been covering that.
No, I mean, I think he has, done a lot with the debt problem. He's made it worse. I'm still waiting for all my T-Twizzler friends who were berating me in 10 and 11 about how ballooning our deficits were being during that period. I'm still waiting for them to make a peep. Haven't heard anything. Crickets the last year.
Yeah, and I don't know how much you talk about the debt deficit issue as merely a political issue, because the more we know about economic theory, like modern monetary theory, for example, I actually have been saying now for about 6 or 12 months that even talking about debt and deficit as the left in the same terms that the right uses is kind of a losing game, because the right doesn't actually care about that. They use it merely as a political issue. And now we know that actually that's not necessarily bad if it's being used for the right things. If it's to give tax cuts to the rich, it's not good.
Of course.
If it's to fund programs that are economically stimulative, it's not actually a bad thing. So I think it's really important not to allow the debate to be in their terms, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. And, we've talked about it, thousands of times over the years that, it goes back to, economics 101. If you're going out, if you're laid off and you go out and buy a suit and get a resume done on your credit card, that's great. If you go and take an Alaskan vacation because, hey, I got the time, not so good.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same thing applies to governance. And we know that food stamp money, for example, has an economic multiplier that is really, really high. So the government spending $1 million on food stamps stimulates the economy in a way that giving $1 million to rich people who will mostly just stick it in bank accounts doesn't. And it's the exact same point you're making at like the family budget level.
I mean, at the end of this, and this is the reason I talk about debt and deficits are in those exact terms. Look, it's not horrible, but at some point it does matter. I mean, by 2028, we're going to be at 100% of debt to GDP. That's starting to look like, we're heading towards trouble, though, especially if we're spending it on things like huge tax cuts and not infrastructure and not education and not healthcare. And you could go down the list of all the things that I would like to see spending on, not tax cuts for people who don't need it.
Yeah, for sure. And especially, a lot of the China stuff that has been reflexively thrown out by the right over the last year or two does not make a lot of sense. What really does make a difference is when you put in place something like tariffs, which are going to be economically damaging, and you do it because you want to get back at China, yet they do hold a ton of our debt, a ton of our bonds. That's just a vicious cycle, and that's almost been completely missing from the conversation.
Well, let me ask you about this, because I'll be honest, I think we need to be talking about tariffs. I think there are some good things that come of it if done properly. I think this guy's screwing it up, and it's going to end up being something we don't do down the road because of how bad he boogers it up. But at some point, you've got to look at our trade deficits, which last year, $375 billion in goods of things that we bought from the Chinese that they didn't buy from us. That is unsustainable, no matter which party you are or which side of the argument you find yourself. And I don't know how else, other than some type of tariff system, you control that or you bring that down, because, hey, the free market evidently isn't working. The leveling of the invisible hand, not working with this.
This is very complicated, but so you have to kind of take a step back and think about it in a different way. If we were starting at zero right now and designing trade policy and building relationships with other countries from the ground up, where we didn't already have so many of the goods we buy costing less because we buy them from certain other countries, if we were like starting at zero, it would be a very, very different conversation than Donald Trump being elected, coming in January of 2017 and imposing all of this stuff. Given that he's not starting off trade policy, but has to work within the context we have, the problem is there's no off-ramp, right, Rick? So he puts in place a tariff, China matches it. So all of a sudden, that's bad for American workers, number one, because more stuff is going to be made elsewhere. And number two, it's bad for American workers because the products they buy are going to cost more because of those tariffs. And the question is, what's the off-ramp? What's the off-ramp to this trade war? And I agree with you that in principle, it would be great if we were starting in a different place, but we're not. And no serious economist has been able to explain, how do you exit the trade war?
Well, I mean, no one has said how you get out of it other than you come to the table and you renegotiate the terms of which you're currently doing things.
Which takes years.
Which takes, obviously takes time. But, you know, this took a very short period of time to go from balanced trade, you know, just, you know, two decades ago to completely unsustainable. And continually losing, you know, millions of manufacturing jobs we've already lost, the future technology we're going to lose, and the lowering of wages that has already happened. I just don't know how you can continue down this path. And this is where I've taken heat for saying, you know, maybe Trump has a point on this issue. I think he's going to booger it up, and that's my great fear. But something has to be done.
Yeah, I agree. I just don't think this is the approach, and it's probably a bigger conversation than we're having today.
Right.
But I think if you look bigger picture at trade wars between countries like the U.S. and China, something has to be done doesn't mean this is what has to be done.
Yeah, good point. Well, we can have that conversation another day. I do want to get your thoughts on interesting moment today in the Manafort trial. The judge abruptly stopped testimony at a little break. No explanation that I can find. Curious your thoughts on what's going on there.
Yeah, I don't know the specific explanation for what happened today either, but this is a trial that is really, really important for a bunch of different reasons. Number one, because Manafort, despite attempts from the Trump administration and campaign to say this guy was basically the equivalent of a coffee boy, this is a guy who had a serious role within the Trump campaign. This is a guy who is heavily involved in the selection of Mike Pence, and that could prove to be important depending on where these trials and the Trump-Russia investigation goes, because there's this idea that Pence has nothing to do with any of this stuff. It's important to remember that the guy who's on trial right now for pretty serious crimes was very involved in selecting Mike Pence. So we could end up finding out in the next 3 or 6 months that Pence is much more wrapped up in this than has been discussed. So this isn't 13 Russians in Russia who will never actually face trial. This is a real criminal trial connected to insiders that knew what was going on during the campaign. So I think this is huge.
Yeah, but to this point, what we've seen is it's been kind of boring in that it's all about taxes and it's all about coats and satin panties and whatever else he bought.
Hours and hours of trial. It doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter what the accusations are. Hours and hours of trial are rarely exciting.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I've been to some that are pretty fun. But, you know, here's the thing that's interesting. To me, anyway, that Rick Gates, who was supposedly his, you know, his right-hand man was actually stealing from him. I mean, you've got him who, you know, they've kind of painted as this thug, as this person who's had people killed, and yet his right-hand man's robbing him blind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to find out is that they're not only all criminals with regard to the outside world, even within the organization, it's going to be made abundantly clear that it's rife with immoral, depraved criminality. And we've even started to see this. I mean, look at the conflict that now exists between Trump and his supposed confidant, Michael Cohen, who loved him so much that he paid Stormy Daniels by mortgaging his own house. Now, all of a sudden, they despise each other. So I think that we've only started to see 2% of what we're going to learn was going on within that organization.
No, I mean, we also find out that originally, I guess, the meeting at Trump Tower, I guess it didn't happen. And then it was about adoption. And then it was about who knows. And we don't know who was there. The SE was there. No, they weren't there. And now we find that there was actually a meeting before that meeting to say that, there was another meeting.
Yeah, Rudy Giuliani seemingly accidentally admitting that there was a pre-meeting on CNN.
You buying any of that?
And then hours later, I'm sorry, what?
Are you buying any of that? That he just now finding out? Are you buying this kind of bumbling, stumbling kind of, oops, I let it out, but I shouldn't have? Are you buying any of that?
It's either brilliant strategy to confound and confuse where people basically give up. And it's like Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, where they say, I don't even know what to believe at this point, right? It's either brilliant strategy or there's really just a total lack of communication between them. I think it could be both. I think Giuliani doesn't really know what's going on, but then he uses it to try to muddy the water and confuse people. I think it's a hybrid strategy.
Yeah, but back to the double meeting. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just had to get that out. But you know, now we're finding out there was this second meeting. Are you surprised by this now that this admission came out?
No, not at all. I mean, the original story that this was a meaningless meeting at Trump Tower with Russian individuals about so-called adoptions that Trump didn't know about in advance, wasn't involved in drafting the letter explaining what happened after that. That was never believable, right? And every single week we learn, oh, the timing of Trump's tweets suggests he did know about the meeting ahead of time. Oh, and actually there was an attempt to follow up about the supposed dirt on Hillary. Oh, and it turns out not only did they email about it, but there was also a meeting in advance to discuss the fact that they were having this meeting. We're moving in one direction, Rick, and it's towards this was a calculated and planned meeting and that this was a deliberate attempt to work together against Hillary Clinton.
I mean, my original assessment of it back, you know, inauguration day when we began talking about all of this stuff, and even before, was that, you know, you've got Kushner, you've got, you know, Junior, you've got the rest of them who just have this kind of blind ambition and this arrogance that they're above the law and that they can do whatever they want. And it seems that's playing out. And it seems like they want to get caught. I mean, they don't want to be punished, but they want to be caught so they can flout the idea that, hey, we did all this stuff.
Yeah, I think that there is this brazen sort of they can't touch us attitude. And you know what? It may actually work out that way, right? Particularly if you've got a Republican House and Senate, which would be responsible for acting on whatever comes of the investigation. They may be right. They really may end up unscathed.
Well, I mean, I hope not. I'm hoping November is that moment where we hold them accountable and we throw a bunch of these bums out and we end up putting some folks in who will hold them accountable. And if some of the elections we've seen to this point give us any hope, it is that blue wave could possibly happen if people, you know, if they march to the polls like I hope they will on November 6th.
Yeah, I think we have to think about every election in November as 50-50, right? You don't assume that it's out of reach for the left, but you also don't assume that the more progressive candidate has it in the bag. Like, just assume every race is 50-50, and if there's an opportunity to vote, you go and vote, and that has to be the attitude. Otherwise, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I would go with the other, even more farther out than that. Assume that the Republicans are going to do everything they can do to cheat, and then assume that the Russians are probably going to have a hand in it as well.
Yeah, that's less, even more cautious, I guess, than my perspective. But I can't disagree with you.
Yeah, because you know, I look at these last couple elections, the one in Kansas where you got Kobach, who seems to be, you know, I don't know how you could be the Secretary of State and overseeing your own election, but okay, that's happening. And I look at the Ohio 12th, which was really interesting, and it's giving hope, for, to me anyway, come November that there's going to be that blue wave happen.
Yeah, the Ohio one is super interesting because this was, you've got to go back to 1939 for the second Democrat to have held that. There was a Democrat in the early 80s who had that seat. And then before that, you've got to go back to 1939. Whether, you know, 1,700 votes one direction or the other, that's massive when it comes to what we might expect in November. But I, like on my show, every time I say that, I always say, but don't assume that that's how all of these races are going to go. You've got to go and vote because I am genuinely scared that, you know, turnout in midterms is always low.
Right.
And this is like the midterm that everybody needs to vote in. So I, at every opportunity, say, whatever happened in Alabama or Ohio or wherever, you've got to vote.
No, I mean, those things happened because people did get out to vote. And at the end of it, you're right. I'm accused of being hyperbolic, but yeah. This is the election of my lifetime. This is it. I don't see anything positive other than 2 years after that. There's no point just being a little hyperbolic, maybe, or maybe it is the election of our lifetime.
And by the way, real quick, midterms, because the turnout is often so low, every person's vote counts just a little bit more, right? It's slightly more likely that your vote will end up making that difference because turnout is so low in midterms in the United States.
Yeah, and which is just bizarre to me. And at the end of it, I don't get it. I don't know why people aren't passionate about voting. I mean, I've been a super voter since I've been 18. I've not missed an election. And I think it's your responsibility as a citizen. And I want other people to have that kind of belief that they have control of their government and that this is a government of, for, and by we the people.
Yeah. And what I always tell people who say, David, listen, it doesn't matter if I vote because no election is ever determined by one vote. Every time I hear people say that, I say, but hold on a second. If everybody who had that thought decided to stay home or decided to vote as a group, you do decide the election.
Yep. Well, we're now seeing these stories coming out now that just the other day I read the headline that that it wasn't, you know, white working class voters that voted in Trump. It wasn't union members. It was actually the people who didn't bother voting because their numbers were much bigger than the other ones. But back to your point about the 1,700 votes and I wanted to get one last thought from you. The 1,700 votes in Ohio's 12th. Are we blaming the Green Party yet? Can we blame them or no?
Listen, I think that it's perfectly reasonable to talk about the mathematics of when the Green Party or the Libertarian Party receives a candidate, gets more votes than the difference between the Democrat and the Republican. On a mathematical level, that could be responsible for flipping the election. But what you also have to remember is that the total turnout is also affected by who's running and the number of candidates. And I think that, you know, as someone who wants third parties to have more of an impact but believes that ranked choice voting combined with campaign finance reform is necessary to actually give third parties a real impact, I hesitate to start pointing fingers in that way, even if mathematically you can make a case for that.
Yeah, I mean, because I look in Montana, for instance, the story just broke, I guess it was the day before yesterday, that in Montana in the Senate race against John Tester, the Green Party sent out a blast email on Monday saying, hey, we need a candidate, somebody quick. And it turns out somebody who worked for the Republican Party actually threw his name and he's going to be running as the greenie there in Montana.
And we will see whether they get enough votes to have potentially swung that, right? I mean, it's simple math at the end of the day.
That's scary stuff. David, I appreciate the time, the thoughts, good stuff.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rick.
I hope people will check out your work and the things that you do. David is the host of The David Pakman Show, nationally syndicated radio host. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.